Music and Booze with Mo is co-produced and distributed by Nitty Grits, the media division of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, changing the world one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there's a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink.
Well, all right. Star Child, citizens of the universe, recording angels. We have returned to claim the pyramid. Partying on the mothership, I am the mothership connection. Get down in 3D. Light year groove. Well, all right. You hear the noise? Ain't nobody but me and the boy.
For this episode, we are back in New Orleans, a place that we like to pop into, to talk with Christophe Dorneman of the French 75 Bar at Arnaud's. He is the head bartender there and bar manager. And how on earth did he land a gig like that? Well, we're going to find out. We're also going to find out if funky violin is a thing in this gentleman's life. So let's get to it.
Start this by having you introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and where you work.
All right. My name is Christophe Dorneman. Mm-hmm. I am the bar manager and head bartender at the French 75 Bar at the historic Arnaud's restaurant.
In New Orleans.
In the French Quarter.
You look like you're 12 years old, so how can you already have achieved this pinnacle of success?
Well, I'm older than 12. I'm 30.
But you don't have to tell me your age.
Okay.
It's just more of a like, yeah. My goodness, you seem young to have achieved so much. But maybe you just packed in a lot in those years.
Yeah, I don't know. I've learned semi-recently that I suffer from imposter syndrome severely. So
Imposter syndrome?
Yeah, which basically means like you attribute all of the good things in your life to just sheer luck.
Oh.
But the reality is like I don't fully believe in luck. I mean, but there are certain happenstances that happened that if I look back, I'm just like, I can't believe how this worked out.
You took advantage of a turn.
Yeah, and
you know.
So I do not have a long history in bartending. I've literally learned how to bartend here. Mm-hmm. I worked here 6 years, and I only really became a bartender after the first year or so. Mm-hmm. So I've only bartended for about 5 years.
Are you from New Orleans originally?
No. My family is from Baton Rouge originally.
Okay.
But my mom lives in Minneapolis. I grew up in Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty different than Baton Rouge.
Yes.
Or New Orleans.
Yes.
Everything's different from New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. I have family. I mean, my family has a long history in New Orleans. I have a lot of family who lived in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't terribly foreign to you or anything?
No. And I had come to Louisiana at least once every year of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But New Orleans is kind of more of a special place where you go for celebration in the Oaks and special mm-hmm. events and things. So it was a little more foreign to me, despite having Louisiana heritage.
So how did you wind up at Arnaud's?
So that's one of these weird
twists
of fate. Yeah, I was working. I started just kind of as a table server at a little Vietnamese restaurant, and mm-hmm. then I worked at a diner, and then I actually started working in kitchens. And the restaurant that I was working at was going through some really rough times. And my mom had a business event and knew a friend whose you know, former significant other was the manager of Brennan's. And that I jumped from basically working at an elevated diner, but a diner to fine dining.
Yeah.
And then Brennan's closed. There was this, there's kind of this whole dramatic story of how Brennan's got shut down. Mm-hmm. And then the friend, my friend, knew another person who had a party here every year, who knew the sales manager.
Oh my goodness.
And I didn't even know this restaurant, to be honest, I didn't even know it existed. Mm-hmm. So I was very ignorant of these old Nolan's, you know.
Yeah.
Gems.
As you know, this is one of the most historic.
Yes.
You know?
So, so we came one summer and applied, and it worked because, you know, Brennan's was, we were making Bananas Foster tableside. We were doing that kind of style service.
Yeah.
So in the interview, you know, oh, do you guys make, you know how to make Bananas Foster? Oh, yeah, I do. I make like 100 a day, you know. So it was a very quick transition. Like, oh, good. You have basic fine dining, and you can do these flambés, which is one thing that I would say sets some of these restaurants apart.
Yeah.
You can get Bananas Foster in other restaurants in the city.
Yeah.
But that old-school performance, you know, that's a very specific place that you can get that at. So.
So how did you make it from, you were serving and then you started bartending? So you switched over to that side of the service.
Yes. Well, it was it took a long time because...
Did you want to change over to that, or did it just sort of happen as well?
Once again, this is a case where I have to give myself some props, but the reality is that I was doing these cooking pop-ups on the side, and it was kind of taking a lot of my spare time, so I was not studying. You have to study, you know, the wines and basic liquors, things like that.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't, but the management were like, you should be studying up, you should be a front waiter. There's like a three-tiered waiting system, like you should be moving up and you're not studying. And I was like, yeah, I know, but I'm just doing my own thing, you know? So they put me, I was bar backing occasionally, and it's called floating, and I would go and help the bar out. And so then they're like, well, you should go do some shifts in the bar as a table server, basically as a cocktail server, and that will help you learn.
That was really nice of them to kind of guide you along an educational path.
Well, that's funny because I don't think that's the way that they were seeing it. I think they were like, "You go do this and do your homework." And,
but it
actually ended up guiding me. Exactly.
Well, it sounds like they were tough loving you.
Yes, exactly.
looking back,
I'm just like, I was such an idiot. Like, why didn't I? But I had no idea. And at that time, in my mind, I knew that a martini came in a martini glass, and that's pretty much the extent of what I knew.
Wow.
But that's it. The only other thing I knew is that I liked the taste of a dark and stormy because I didn't understand it, but I liked the bit ginger and the dark rum, and I was that's the extent of my cocktail knowledge at that point.
So then what flipped the switch in you?
So because I had been working in kitchens and came from kind of a cooking background, I would go in, and they were always making their own cordials and syrups and things like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is not what I was expecting to be setting up the bar. Was, you know, having a pot and a burner and working on all these ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And so that element drew me in. But to be honest, even after that, I had a tough time. It was a cigar bar at the time, which I enjoyed to an extent, but I would feel pretty much...
It's really oppressive.
Yeah, I would feel sick every day. Yeah. I was, you know, just concerned for my health. And to be fair, the bartenders were not very... they were very guarded. Mm-hmm. Because, and I've learned this from experience, you know, you never know when you get some young punk coming and working in your bar, is this somebody who cares, or is this somebody who's just here for the paycheck or whatever? Mm-hmm. And so I think that they were not super friendly. They weren't rude. They just were not very open and talkative. And so I was frustrated because I'm a pretty talkative person, and I was also trying to learn. So I was like, hey, what's this? Who's this? And I think for a while they were just kind of like, they would talk to me in about four words and sentences, and that would be it. So there was actually a point, and this is also hilarious to think about, where I went to the managers and I was like, I never want to work in that bar. Like, I hate it. I hate the smoke. Nobody's talking to me. I don't know what's going on. Like, it's driving me crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't remember the time frame. It's weird thinking about that, but there was a time frame where literally one day, Hattie Kateri, who was kind of like the second in command bartender who helped kind of build the bar with Chris, he goes, hey, I feel like I'm not trying to, I'll try to be humble to an extent, but he was like, I think you're too smart for this job. Do you want to learn something? Like, he kind of could tell, like, I was just like, had this,
anxious.
Yeah, this like, anxious yeah. energy, and I'm yeah. like, I can't just stand here and not talk yeah. or do something.
He was going to so, harness you.
Yeah.
Corral that, you know.
And I think, I can't remember if he first, he's like, I think he's just like, do you want to make a Front 75? And he just taught me one drink. Mm-hmm. And it was just the act of, you know, using my hands to put something in and create something. Mm-hmm. It kind of, within a day, I went back to the management and I was like, I want to bartend and I want to be in the bar. Like, I want to be exclusively a bartender.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, it took months. It took multiple times where they were like, you're not cutting it. Like, you're yeah. too slow. This is yeah. not, you're not going to be a bartender. Not the wow. bartenders, but through their yeah. restaurant, you know, I mean, like I said, I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to make a drink or two. It's not the same as having to serve drinks for 200 covers, you mm-hmm. know, on a Friday.
I was going to say, because you're making the drinks for the entire restaurant as well.
Yes. Well,
and
so we have three.
Bar.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. three bars.
Okay.
And so when you kind of work your way up, you you know, you do basically you generally start with doing table service in the 75 so that you. Mm-hmm. You know, learn how cocktails look.
Yeah.
You're not making anything. You're just doing table service. But you yeah. kind of learn the liquors. You learn how they look, learn the garnishes. And then eventually you train in one of the other bars, usually the Richelieu bar, mm-hmm. which is a service bar, but you also have to serve guests. Mm-hmm. And so in those days, if you're just using that one bar, you'll serve up to 200 guests. Or you're doing all the drinks yeah. for the dining room.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it gets crazy.
It gets hectic in
yeah.
there. Yeah.
Because it's craft cocktails, but high volume. So
you had to pull yeah. yourself together.
Yeah, I mean, I did not cut it. I was not good. And I, to be honest.
But you wanted to be good?
Yeah, yeah, okay. I did.
So you're challenging yourself as
yes.
well. As, so more tough love.
Yes.
From above.
That's where I can say that I got a lot of luck along the way, but there was a long time where I fought and struggled mm-hmm. and begged to work.
To keep doing it.
Give me another chance. Give me another chance. I know I'm not gonna suck as much. I'll be faster and like that kind of. And it was really just about like speed because
yeah.
I was so careful to make everything perfect. And as much as you have to do that, you have to learn how to do that as fast as possible.
Yeah. So what was one of the first drinks on this menu that you felt you conquered? You were like, yes, have this one down. Like
a
difficult drink.
Probably the trickiest one. I mean, the 75. Is not that hard because yeah. you learn especially if you come from kitchens, you learn the measurements, you pour. Mm-hmm. To be honest though, the first thing that I find a lot of bartenders like in the very beginning struggle with is what I call like the karate chop, which is basically when you're done shaking your cocktail, cracking the tins off.
I don't bartend.
Yeah.
But I do that at home. I'll make those and that's. I get there and I'm like, oh, I know there's a trick. I know yeah. there's a trick.
And it's
I'm
like this
like
little
whacking
sweet
it
spot.
Against the sink. I'm like hitting it on my hip. Yeah. You know, I never do it right. But I see the bang. You hit yeah. it. You hear that pop.
Yeah.
And when I hear that pop, I'm like, oh, I need to learn that trick.
It seems so. You don't even think about it. If you don't know. Nope. You don't even think about it.
Nope.
But every time I've trained somebody brand new, uh-huh. they'll stand there just whacking it, and they just cannot
it
get it.
Do it.
And then after a while, they're like. Well, my hand hurts. I'm like, I understand. You're still going to have to keep doing it.
Yeah.
And like, I had people try to do it on the bar. I'm like, you're not going to do that.
It on the bar.
So,
not here.
That honestly was the first little trick mm-hmm. because the thing is, I tell people like craft cocktails. I mean, if you're measuring everything, that's not really the hard part, at least for me. It's not,
yeah.
you know, you learn the measurements and you measure yeah. and you pour and you shake, yeah. but it's all these weird little techniques like popping the tins. Even just a proper shake. I mean, mm-hmm. so I watch a brand new bartender's like that. You're not shaking it properly and yeah. it will not turn out right.
Yeah.
Little things like that, even just the fluidity of grabbing your strainer, mm-hmm. rinsing your tin, things like that, that is the harder part. Stirring while mm-hmm. shaking that stuff. Mm-hmm. Those little tricks are the harder elements that you can't just teach and then it's done.
Yeah.
It's repetition, repetition,
yeah.
repetition, repetition.
Yeah.
And then guidance. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I would say we don't measure our Sazeracs, and our Sazeracs are very sacred. We have the longest continuously made recipe for a Sazerac in the city.
Oh.
So it's never been changed for, I think, 50 years at this point.
Yeah, that's one of those drinks in this city that is contested, right?
Yes.
Like, who originated the Sazerac where? How many bars in the city claim it?
I don't know who claims it, but anybody who claims it that's not at the Sazerac Bar in the Roosevelt is pretty much lying. and not saying that, like, oh, that current bar as it is where it was invented. But that was the location of kind of the original Sazerac.
Totally. So you guys take a lot of pride in your Sazerac.
And ours is very unique. It is non-traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes, from what I've witnessed, it comes from the fact that we also are high volume. Mm-hmm. So it had to be fast, efficient. And so what we do, we rinse the glass with herb saint. We don't use Epsom. Mm-hmm. And we have chilled glasses. We rinse the glass with herb saint. We chill our rye whiskey, which is different than a lot of bars.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a dash of a very small amount of simple syrup. We do not do the sugar cube method.
Mm-hmm.
And we splash a little bit of cold water and just do a quick stir. So we don't throw it on ice. We don't stir them separately. We basically just splash a little cold water, chill the whiskey. And what comes from that is, yes, you can make a lot very fast, but it's less diluted than most Sazeracs in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And we also leave a decent amount of herb saint in the glass, which is different. A lot of people rinse and they toss it all out.
Yeah.
And from what we found is a lot of locals, a lot of bartenders have grown to really love our Sazeracs because it's a richer, it's a slow sipping Sazerac. And it's kind of like, if you're a cook, you start wanting, the longer you work in this industry, you want those richer, deeper flavors and notes.
Mm-hmm.
And every bit of dilution takes away from that experience. So I think ours is very special.
And this has been the way it's been served for
over 40 years. I know that we are the longest continuing. I wish I knew that exact number.
Yeah, but it's around there.
Yes.
It's been more than a couple
of decades. It's the longest continuously made recipe for Sazerac in the
city.
That's
amazing. So, yeah. That's so insane. So you've got the classics. And I know that you guys, especially we're here during Tales of the Cocktail, and you'll host pop-ups or have guest bartenders. Do you guys have an opportunity? Is there something on the menu? I'm just not remembering off the top of my head. Where you guys get to create your own cocktails. You have a couple signatures that aren't those historical ones. Maybe each bartender gets a shot at coming up with a new drink. So you guys get to exercise those muscles as well.
Oh, absolutely. And and honestly, we make classic cocktails.
Yes.
Constantly. But it is a misconception that we are only a classic cocktail bar. Cocktail menus are all original creations. So if you look at our menu, there's a French 75, of course.
Yeah.
And then everything else is a unique creation from the program. Mm-hmm.
So when did you get to start creating? What point did they allow you to be like, all right, Chris, let's see what you got.
I think it was, I was probably self-conscious. So I didn't create any drinks for the bar program for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was doing all these pop-ups at home and doing these side gigs. And that was my way of...
R&D.
Yeah. It was, hey, this is my pop-up, so I'm going to do all my own cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I crafted pretty much all my first menus. And after a while, a lot of times I was like, well, these are not worthy of coming to the restaurant, the 75 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'll just keep it separate. I'm not going to worry about it. And then I think, some people are like, you should totally, why don't you do this at the bar or whatever? And I think every once in a while I would pick one and like, I think maybe I can try this one and see what Chris thinks and have them taste this one. And the very first drink that I got on the menu is the Creole Fashion, which I feel a little self-conscious because I was young, I didn't know anything, and to call something the Creole Fashion where I have no Creole bone in my body.
Oh, yeah.
I have limited.
That's very kind of you, actually.
You're a young kid. I was young and I was just like, yeah, the Creole Fashion, because that's such an iconic,
you're going with identity right?
Yeah, and
which works, because there's Creole seasoning and, the style food, so.
Yeah, and it was a combination of Italian, French, Louisiana flavors.
What was this drink?
It sounds savory.
I like a savory drink, but
The thing is, I don't. I don't have these great stories of why I come up with these things, but part of it, honestly, was the Luxardo cherries, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So we were not using the syrup from the cherries. But the syrup is delicious.
Oh, it's totally delicious. God, I love that stuff.
Yeah, and we were just rinsing it off the cherries, and it was just going down the drain.
Oh, that's terrible.
I know, and I was
that's what happens everywhere, so.
A lot of, it's very,
that stuff.
It's very rare.
I've seen it a few times. I have it at home, and I'll, get a little spoonful. You know, it's like eating syrup out of the bottle or something, you know?
Yeah, and I was like, man, this is just such a waste of such a delicious thing. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was just kind of a process of, well, what are some, like, you know, iconic elements from New Orleans? Okay, what goes in Old Fashioned, first of all?
Yeah.
So how do you sweeten Old Fashioned? And then it's like, okay, well, what is that sweetener? And Steen's cane syrup is a classic. It's, you know, you get it instead of maple syrup for pancakes in a lot of places, things like that. And it's this rich cane syrup that has these deep molasses notes. And I thought, well, that would probably do really well with an Old Fashioned. It was originally a rye whiskey drink because rye whiskey, you know, permeates New Orleans classic cocktails. So it was Steen's cane syrup and the Luxardo cherry syrup combined. And I would take fresh thyme and a little bit of like an herbal Amaro, like an Italian Amaro.
Wow.
And kind of mix that all in and cook the thyme into all of that. And then that's the syrup.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds delicious.
And and it was just kind of one of those things like, I can't say it was inspired. It was just like, hey, that tastes good. Hey, that tastes good. Let's mix all this stuff. Oh, that tastes really good.
And now let's add booze.
Yeah. And then.
Just the right booze.
Yeah. And then, you know, hey, I really like Wild Turkey rye. I want to do this rye whiskey Old Fashioned because everyone else is doing bourbon.
Yeah.
And then it was also bitters. I wasn't going to make my own bitters, but. You know, I actually did not.
Sorry, okay.
The three iconic bitters in bartending is orange, Angostura, and Peychaud's. Mm-hmm. And being you're in New Orleans, Peychaud's is part of our culture.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it was a simple act of, okay, I'm just going to blend the three together, equal parts. Oh, wow, that tastes good. And so, it was like, oh, this is a simple enough of an Old Fashioned, but it's unique enough at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And
awesome.
Yeah, and then eventually it was on the menu, and then all of a sudden it was on the menu for like 4 years.
That's so great, though. You're kind of stoked on that, I'm sure.
and it's weird because I'm like, that was my first drink, and it's one where I'm like, actually, it holds up. There's some drinks that you make early on in your career, and you go back and you're like, no way. But that one, I was like, you know what? Actually, I'm still pretty happy about that one.
Music and Booze podcast, so we have to talk about music too.
I was wondering,
and someone told me that you play trumpet.
No.
Okay.
But I was a musician for a long time.
That
was actually a violin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We actually do have a trumpet player in our bar program, so there is that is partially true.
maybe that's what they were thinking. Who the person they were thinking of. You played violin? Did you actually perform for people as well?
Yes, so
was this outside of like a school performance kind of thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you really played violin.
Yes, I
you have one of those brains. You can tell. That's why they could recognize it in you. Violin is not an easy thing.
No, it is not. And I'll tell, I was not good for most of my time as a violinist, and it took. but it was one of those things where I started very young, but I was not one of those prodigies.
Why were you determined to stick with it? Because most kids start playing an instrument and it's not easy.
Yeah.
You know, the first 6 months, and they like move on to whatever else is cool.
It's weird because I don't actually know why. Because I was not good, and I had, but part of it, and I'm not blaming the teachers, but I did not have good teachers, and it's not blaming them.
You
it's
need to have the teacher that inspires you, and that's a certain combination of you and that teacher.
Yeah, and I started, I think, when I was six, and all I know is that when I was really, really young, like 3 years old, I told my parents, I saw some violinist do a concert, and I said I wanted to do that. And so my parents were like, well, let's try to make this happen.
That's awesome.
But I had, the reason why I know that I didn't have very good teachers for a while is that when I did, everything changed. But it was not until I was 16.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was most of my violining whatever, yeah. playing was just...
I like violin.
Yeah, that's not that. Proper, but whatever.
But I know what you meant, so I think it counts.
Yeah. Was just a small school orchestra, you know, just...
Yeah.
I can't imagine what those concerts are like for my parents. Probably not very great. And even, and you know, you're a kid, it's like, you don't want to practice. You want to play video games and do...
You want to do the other stuff.
And I remember I had a teacher, and all of a sudden, I don't know what it was, but she was just guiding me in the right way where my, it was, you know, an exponential growth as opposed to, oh, another year here. It was just like within a few months, everything changed.
Yeah.
And I remember by the time I was in orchestra in junior high, and in high school, at the beginning of my high school career, I was the very last chair in the second violin, so the back of the room.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't give a...
You didn't care. You can swear on this.
I did not care.
I don't know if you want to swear in this beautiful place where you work, but you can swear on this podcast.
It would be disingenuous for me not to swear.
There we go.
No, I didn't care. I was like the class clown. I was such a slacker. And within a year...
Slacker played violin.
Yeah.
That's like not usually where you go with that. You're supposed to be smoking
weed
in the parking
lot. You'd be surprised. Yeah.
Maybe you were doing that too.
No comment. No, but within a year, I went from the back of the second violins to the front of the second violins, and then the next, by my junior year, I was second chair of the first violins, and I was in chamber orchestra and everything. Like, it was a huge change.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So what kind of pieces do you play? I mean, I'm assuming it's all classical kind of stuff, because that's my only understanding.
Originally, so I had only done classical through all my orchestra time, and towards the... I would say my senior year and after, I got a new teacher because just the other teacher moved away, and that teacher was a gypsy jazz violinist.
Oh.
And so then I started learning jazz violin because I wanted to...
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I can't remember which came first, but I did some... I went to Berklee School of Music in Boston for a few summers, and then I did their like 5-week summer program. I
went to UC Berklee, so I always like to meet Berklee people.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
You guys have two E's, we have the Y.
Yes. Yeah, like, very few people.
Yeah.
They see the name, they don't, and I can always be like, oh, that's that Berklee and that's that one.
Yeah, but I've met quite a few people from who've gone there for either a music business school kind of thing or studying, and all just dedicated and very talented. So you were there you did a couple summer sessions there.
Yeah, I did some short summer sessions, and it was kind of a case of, oh, I'm doing bluegrass class, and this is more fun now than just classical. And then it was a funk class, and all this stuff kind of
funk
opened.
Violin?
Oh, yeah.
There's funk violin. I'm not...
I know. That was my original
dream to do it, because
it doesn't exist, really.
You would be... everyone would be putting you on their records.
Yeah.
You know? You're the only funk violinist.
Yeah.
what's a song with funk violin? Sorry, we're totally gearing off, but that's just...
I don't know, honestly.
We're going to find it. We're going to discover that.
But one of my favorite genres is funk, and like that's what I like to listen to. Unfortunately, I started with violin, so it
just didn't
translate, but it was a goal of mine.
Why didn't your parents give you a bass when you were young?
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm obsessed with bass. Bass is like my favorite thing to listen to is like an amazing bassist.
Yeah.
So I did Berklee, and then I had this gypsy jazz teacher, and he was also an amazing teacher, and it was the same thing where I thought I was doing okay, and then after a year of him, I was like, oh my God, I'm actually becoming a real like musician. I felt like it.
Aww.
And then that was part of the reason I came to New Orleans. I had family here, and I kind of had two tracks. I was writing a lot, and so Loyola had a pretty well-renowned music department, and the head of their orchestra program was a conductor that I was familiar with in Minnesota that I loved. And so I was like, well, I'm going to go to New Orleans, and I'm going to try to do music, and if that doesn't work out, I'll do writing, and we'll see what happens. And so that's actually the main reason I came to New Orleans.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you came here, did you start playing? Were you busking on the street, too?
I bust a lot in Minnesota, and then I never bust here, which I kind of regret. But it took a while, and to be honest, it was just... I didn't really know how to go about just being like, hey, can I play violin for your band? Like, it's not, it doesn't fit in a lot of bands.
Yeah, I guess
and
that's true.
They didn't have a jazz violin teacher or anything, so I was still kind of stuck in the classical era. And honestly, you know, going from where I was like, oh, in my high school, I was second chair. Yeah. All of a sudden, I go to college, and I'm like, oh, I'm barely making it. Like, I'm just scraping by. Everybody's flying past me, and I'm like, and this kid started at 3 years old and has a $10,000 violin. I'm just like, why don't my violin is $600? And I just felt like out of place. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to focus on the writing. And then I met with some friends, and I really sadly do not remember how this all happened, but I finally got to jam with this band called Dirty Bourbon River Show.
Dirty Bourbon River Show.
Yes.
That's
and they were just starting out, and they sadly just had their kind of farewell, like their final performance. But they were very big. They toured a lot, and I was very, very lucky to play with them. I played all around New Orleans. I played every venue in New Orleans that you can think of. I got to at least play once.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so
that's really cool.
I got to do that. And that was sort of the very end of that was me once again kind of going through another phase of, I think I need to take this more seriously. I need to start practicing like 3 hours a day. I wasn't that kind of person. I was it's like I was a slacker in the sense that, hey, I can get away with this if I just try enough.
You're a very hardworking slacker, though, from what I've picked up. You've called yourself that twice here, but I'm also someone who has a hard time tooting my own horn.
Yeah.
I think that's where you're
well,
at.
And it was just one of those things where, hey, if I can just practice like a little bit a day and make it this far, why do I need to practice 3 hours a day?
Yeah.
And then when you get to the big leagues, you're like, oh, this is why. And then it was just like, towards the end of me playing with them, we were doing bigger shows, and I could tell, you know, I was, my forte was kind of gypsy jazz, sort of free-forming it, but they would do, hey, we want to do a blues song, we want to do a bluegrass song, and do some bluegrass for me, and it's like, it's not easy, it's really, really hard, and I would, you know, do what I could, and then they would kind of look at me like, okay, and then I just could tell, I was like, I am not cutting it. I couldn't just flop, you know, I wasn't at the level where I could switch
genres so quickly,
and just be like, I'm going
to
make this badass blues song and kill it. It was just like, I don't think I know what I'm doing. Another moment of humility of I need to hustle hard. So I finally started doing that. And sadly, that was on the point where they got signed to like a small label. And through the label, they were like, you know what? You guys need to be like a four-piece band, and there's not really a place for violin in this.
Yeah.
And it was kind of that hard conversation where they're like, we love you, man, but, you know, and I was on one of their albums, and it was cool, but, it killed me, but it was, they were right. I was not at the level that I needed to be at. So
further than a lot of musicians get. You know,
FYI. Yeah,
I've worked in the music industry my entire life. That is further than, and I know a lot of band people that is further than a lot of musicians.
It is still one of the best times I've ever had in my
life.
That's
awesome.
Doing that
stuff. That's awesome. So when you were a kid, were you listening to classical music then? Because of, by nature of what you were learning?
Kind of, but that was another thing. I think that's why I never, I wasn't a normal orchestra kid, whereas like you're in the first chair, whatever the first chair violin is like, oh, and he'll start spouting off all these, you know, symphonies that he listens to in his free time, and I'm like listening to James Brown, and I'm like, that's cool, and I love the classical music, and there's now older, you know, there's certain, you know, symphonies and things that I will listen to, and I love, and I totally appreciate, but I was just not, oh, like, who are your favorite violinists? And I was like, I don't listen to violinists.
Well, give me
P-Funk.
Like, okay, so give me, like, for me, I'm not a huge classical music person.
Yeah.
So if I want to hear some good classical violin, what's a piece that you would recommend to me?
You know, it's, I...
There are so
this
many.
You know, it's weird. I have to, it's kind of like going back, way back. The pivotal piece that was sort of my Everest that for... It was Chartus.
Chartus.
Isn't it Chartus?
No idea.
It's spelled like C-Z-A-R-Z. And I am...
And it's pronounced Chartus.
Yeah. I feel really bad.
And who is... That's the name of the piece?
Yes.
And who wrote it?
Vittorio Monti.
Let me look at that.
Yeah. So...
Let me look at your phone.
It's sung by, Chartist, Victoria Monti.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it was the first...
So that's a classical piece that, like...
Well, it's classical, but it's very... If you listen to it, it is... It's gypsy, but it's not gypsy jazz.
Oh, interesting. And this was something you liked when you were younger.
Well, really, it was my teacher at the time was, we're going to practice this classical piece, this Mozart violin concerto for your class. And then here's this kind of raw gypsy violin song that is insanely difficult. And this will be I'm going
to
train you because it works
when
on so many
this,
elements. And
so nailed it. I didn't
know the song before. But then it drew me in and it was like, oh my God, this is so emotional. And so, it makes you get goosebumps. At least it did.
That's awesome.
And
that's
so that
awesome.
Was kind of the song that was like, okay, I'm going to practice this song all the time, constantly. And it's a epic. I mean, if you get to the page 5, you're doing all harmonics and it's really hard. And I sadly feel like I got as close, I would say I got to 80% of like, okay, I'm getting to be able to master this. And I never fully mastered it. So it's kind of on my bucket list to like.
Still master.
Sadly, at one point in New Orleans, my violin got stolen.
Oh, no.
And it was also around the time that I was not playing for that band anymore. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten into cooking with my friends. We started a cooking club.
Yeah.
And what I found in myself is that although I did reluctantly practice for 3 hours, or an hour a day, when we had a catering event or a cooking event or something, I would cook and prep for 15 hours straight. I would stay up all night. And so I started, and then I was also in the music business classes at Loyola, which are amazing. The music industry department there is one of the best I've ever seen. And all these people were talking about, basically becoming an entrepreneur and learning like how to make money on doing something you love. And if you're defining yourself, what are you doing on the side that you're staying up all night and you never think about it as work, but you love it? Can you monetize that? Can this be your way of living? And I remember there was a time where I just started thinking, I was like, you know what? I am up all night cooking and practicing food and doing these events, and I don't think of it as work. I'm just like, I will not stop until this is done perfect.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, you know what? I may be a good musician, but my brain is not disciplined in that. I'm not being a professional musician. I'm not acting as a professional, but I am showing that attention to detail and commitment to this to cooking.
Yeah.
So that's when I kind of realized, you know what, I should maybe look focus on this, and that's when I decided to change my path.
So that's amazing. Yeah. So we have to wrap it up.
I know that. I can talk forever.
I can talk forever too. So I mean, if we had the time, it would just be embarrassing.
Because
we would both be talking far too long. But I wanted to ask you, my brother actually plays bass.
Oh, cool.
He played like kind of the punky, proggy kind of bass, but
nice.
Moved on to gypsy jazz kind of stuff.
Oh, cool.
So. That makes me want to ask you, like, since you fell into that realm doing that, what would you recommend to someone? Can you tell someone, like, okay, if you've never listened to gypsy jazz ever, there's nothing there, here's some, especially since you're coming from a violin standpoint. And in my head, I'm like, I'm just thinking of guitar. I'm not even thinking of violin. So,
Definitely, I mean, yes, it's not violin, but Django Reinhardt is the way to start.
See, that was the first thing that came to mind for me. But I want to hear this
Grappelli.
Stuff.
Stefan Grappelli.
Yeah, I know that name. I just didn't even think about it.
And this may be fact checked on this, but I believe my dad played a lot of Stefan Grappelli for me and Django Reinhardt, and I believe they performed together or at some point recording. But this is a hazy memory. But that's that is one area where I was listening to that because my dad was playing it for me. I'm like, yeah. He's like, you need to listen to this.
That's awesome.
Because I was learning classical, and he's like, yeah, but you need to listen to this. Yeah. And so Django Reinhardt is where you always have to start.
Yeah,
and,
totally.
And a lot of Django Reinhardt, you'll listen. There's a lot of his songs that have violin.
Gosh, I just never. I'm just so tuned into the guitar.
Oh, a lot of these iconic Django Reinhardt songs, go back and listen to them, and it'll be a duel of violin guitar.
Oh,
so
okay.
Half the song, if you pay attention, you're like, oh, this is a whole violin solo, and this whole part of the song is violin. And yeah, so look out for that. Django Reinhardt is a good way to go because a lot of his music has good violin.
Is right there. Okay, cool. Well, on that, we could probably just wrap it up. Yeah. So let everybody know if they want to find you or maybe Arnaud's. Is there social media stuff you want to plug anything like that? You know, what should they know?
It's funny because I have to look at my own Instagram. Because I always forget. But my Instagram is my name. It's just Christoph Dorneman. It's kind of a tricky name to spell. Christoph Dorneman. Very German. But an easier way is my tiki pop-up is Black Pearl Tiki.
Oh, gosh, we didn't even talk about your tiki pop-up because you have this love of tiki.
Yes. Well, that could be
Let's throw that in there real quick. Yeah, I don't know how quick you do it. Let's just do it. So someone told you should know more about tiki, or you had a three dots because it was on the menu here.
Yes, I tasted it and I started falling in love with the tiki cocktails just because of the flavors, the allspice, the falernum, all these really bizarre ingredients. I was like, orshat was one of my first loves. And
yeah, oh my God, orshat's wonderful.
Yeah, and then I bought Sip and Safari, shout out to Beach Bum Berry, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Local.
And I read it on a long layover on my trip to Thailand. And also being in Thailand and being in Southeast Asia, there's all this amazing exotic produce. And I sort of fabricated a fantasy tiki menu of my own using ingredients that, I would map out the cocktails. I had bartender for a little bit, so I knew how to at least build a cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember I still have this old piece of paper at home. And it was just me, like, okay, I think a quarter of this, quarter of this, quarter of this, and three quarter of this, 2 ounces of this rum, blah, and I would just kind of, I wrote them all these little tiki drinks down, and all theoretical, and then when I came back in town, I did these little tiki time parties for my friends.
Yeah.
And eventually, and then I started collecting tiki mugs and buying rum and
tasting
them.
Went down the tiki rabbit hole.
Yes.
Yep.
And then eventually, my friend and coworker sent me a link. He goes, hey, they're doing this pop-up. They're opening this rooftop bar for a pop-up series. You should do tiki time. And I was like, oh. He's like, I don't care. I'll work it. You just do all your drinks, but I think you should do it.
Wow.
And it was the first one, and we did a Fear and Loathing in New Orleans with the event. And it was all my old tiki drinks from my tiki time pop-up.
Yeah.
And it was a huge success. I mean, we sold out of everything. We were slammed.
That's
and
hilarious.
It was like, oh, this is so cool. And everyone was like, when are you doing the next one? When are you doing the next one? And then eventually it was like, okay, well, we got to call it something else than tiki time.
Yeah.
before that, I had a po' boy pop-up that I was planning to call Pearl City Po' Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And the drink that I had that was like the signature drink was called the Black Pearl.
Okay.
After the neighbor. I mean, people are always like, oh, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Kind of, but actually there's a neighborhood in New Orleans where I first moved to in New Orleans called the Black Pearl neighborhood.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so the Black Pearl cocktail was a signature, and I was like, okay, that's the name of the tiki pop-up. So Black Pearl Tiki.
So people can find that on Instagram?
On Instagram, yeah. Okay. And along with all the tiki cocktails, my friend Sergio Gonzalez Pagan is a Puerto Rican chef, and we work together, and we do Southeast Asian Caribbean cuisine.
Yum.
And the food, as much as I love the drinks and I'm a bartender, the food is what I'm the most happy about.
How often do you get to do that? Just a couple times a year?
Before I got the bar manager position, I was doing it every month. And now it's as best as I can do it. We did a historic punch pop-up, or feet focusing on historic punches. We did that.
Oh, that's so cool.
About a month ago.
Tiki's a lot of fun.
Yes.
A month ago. Lot of work too.
And maybe in August I get to do one more, and I'm just spacing it out when I can. But
awesome. So Black Pearl.
Black Pearl Tiki.
Okay,
and
cool.
The Instagram is really cool. We have all of our food and punches and drinks and everything on there. So
awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, with that, we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much, Crystal, for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
No, this is great.
I loved it. I have learned so much today. Yeah. I always do from everybody, but you had a lot of good stuff. So.
Well, and I want to do a little shout out to, obviously, Chrisanna, Hedy Kateri, all the bar team, Victoria,
the French 75 team.
All those people are the only reason I am where I am today, because I knew nothing and now I know quite a bit. And
they're still your friend?
Oh, yeah.
See, that's
even
better.
We all keep in touch. We have our little chat that we send and text each other once in a while. And then on a music note, as much as we talked about all these other musicians, to my top three probably, like the things that I listen to most frequently are Parliament Funkadelic is like one of my favorite bands of all time. Recently, the Ohio Players, just to change the tone, Ohio Players, Parliament Funkadelic, I'm drawing a blank. Roy Ayers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just want to throw some of those out because that's actually my jam. Those are the Meters. Of course, the Meters.
Hello.
I listen to Meters every day. So
you're the future world's most famous funk violinist.
Yeah. Maybe eventually, I don't know.
We'll get there. We'll get there. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries.
Big thanks to Christoph for sitting and talking with us while he was getting ready for a shift at the fabulous French 75. If you're ever in New Orleans, it is a must stop. It is amazing and historical, and you absolutely have to go in there. Of course, it's in the French Quarter. It's the French 75 at our nose. And thank you so much, Christoph. Ask for him, tell him Mo sent you, and make sure you talk about funk so that you can get a little twinkle in his eye and give him an extra tip. He's a real sweetheart. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com and also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thank you for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guest, or if you want to connect with me, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. While you're there, give the show a rating and a review. It really helps to get the word out. If you want to hear the playlists our guests have curated, search She Be Mo on Spotify, S-H-E-B-M-O. Find pictures of the interviewees and the cool stuff they create on the Music and Booze with Mo Instagram account. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.